It was certainly never something I considered, and it's a privilege to actually even have people highlighting that perhaps I might do it. I don't know how to answer this question, Sean, other than I'm in a space where this, yeah. If there was a chance to unite the opposition, certainly in that situation, I would keep my mind open.
Hello again and welcome to the Insights podcast with Sean O'Rourke. My guest is a clinical psychologist and a barrister whose path in life changed direction when she agreed to stand for the local elections in 1999. Catherine Connolly was elected to the Galway City Council. In that first election, she went on to serve as a city councillor for 17 years. And then in 2016, she was elected to Dáil Éireann at the third attempt and then went on to become the first woman to hold the position of Last Count Corla of Dáil Éireann in the last Dáil elected in 2020. An interesting career swerve for someone who admits, you're on record, Catherine Connolly, as saying, I don't like politics. I mean, what's not to like it for somebody who's been involved in it for so many years?
Well, I think politics is a sport to yourself and other people in common. To me, it's something I've never liked. I love music. I love books. I love swimming. I have no problem saying what I love, but I cannot say I love politics, no.
Is it just something that you tolerate or feel you should do because you've been effective at it and you see it's worthwhile?
I'm not sure it's worthwhile, but it's all we've got. The democratic system is all we've got. And I think we need to use it to the best of our abilities and to maximise its potential. I often think it's an illusion, but it's an illusion that helps me to live. So I'm going to hold on to it. There isn't a day of my life that I don't say it's a privilege and I'm paid.
One of the things I've noticed about you in the Dáil that you don't go in for, if you like, trying to land big punches or big sound bites or angry histrionics. You're more, I suppose, analytical and you don't raise your voice insofar as one can see. I mean, is that a deliberate thing on your part? Because
no,
maybe you'd get more headlines if you made more noise.
I don't wish to have more headlines, really. And maybe if you ask my husband, he might give you a different take on the loudness or not of my voice. I have difficulty raising my voice, actually, as I get older. I don't think it's necessary, but it's not something I do deliberately. I think by nature I'm analytical and I think I've got that quality. My sisters and brothers have it as well. It comes just from my background and a large family. And you learn to reflect and you learn to step back. That doesn't mean we didn't have many fights and spontaneous rows, but I think you get an ability to stand back and reflect. And I think we need more of it now more than ever. I think one of the most frustrating things for me is that I find there are solutions to the problems. And I actually despair on occasions, which is a very strong word, I suppose. But I despair of the endless spin and the circularity of the arguments as opposed to an analysis of what caused the problem. I'm sure we'll come to housing at some stage. But when I was elected in 2016 and prior to that in 2011, when I missed out by 17 votes, the same themes have come up over and over. Housing, public housing, the role of the government in funding the local authorities, public health, public childcare. And these are themes that have come up over and over. Mental health. In the 80s, we had planning for the future, which was to fundamentally change mental health. That was followed by a vision for change, which was an excellent document, not implemented. And then we went on to sharing the vision. And so we now have three very good documents. The second document was excellent, the vision for change. And we set up an independent implementation body. And they did such good work that they abolished it after two terms.
Your pre-political careers in psychology and as a barrister obviously have equipped you to analyse and to observe and to bring a lot of experience to politics. But I'd like to go right back, if that's okay with you, yeah. Catherine, because you mentioned being in a large family. How large and where did you come? And you lived in a council house. That's where you grew up, yeah? Mm-hmm,
absolutely, yeah. I lived in Seanthaler. And there were 14 in my family, 7 boys and 7 girls. And it was just normal.
It wouldn't have been a big house. I mean, corporation houses.
I grew up in a privileged background in a sense. You know, we were both inside and outside of the system. I grew up with a father and a mother who loved learning, who wanted to get on. I'm not comfortable really talking about my family. I mean, each one of us will have a different story coming from a family, as most families. So I can't speak for my family. Speaking for myself, it was an absolute privilege. you know. To come from a family of 14, it gives lots of perspectives on life. We have had experience in everything from, I suppose, happiness to sadness, to tragedy, to resilience. Yeah, you know. Yeah.
That importance to your parents, or that love of learning your parents had, it coincided when you were a child, I suppose, with the advent of free education.
It did, absolutely, because I remember, I'm not sure if I have a false memory, but I remember a discussion in the house about could we afford the secondary fees for me or for my brother. My brother got a scholarship, I didn't. But there was a discussion around that. My mother had died before that. So this discussion came up afterwards, and free education came in. I'm not sure, did we pay the fees first or whatever? But certainly there was a discussion around that. Scholarships helped in our house as well, you know.
The importance of learning. You mentioned about your mother, and I don't want to be intrusive, Catherine, but I mean, that must have thrown a lot of responsibility on everybody, particularly the older members of the family.
Yeah, it was a sudden death, you know. My mother was alive on a Friday and gone on a Saturday, but it's something that, you know, you live with, you never get over it. But you never get over any death in a family, in my opinion. You just learn to live with it, and each day it's the same. But I talk to her, I talk to my siblings that have died, you know. They're very much with me and very much with all of us in the house. My father filled the breach, I suppose, and then my eldest sister and then another sister. So Annette took over and then Geraldine, you know. There's a huge sacrifice on both their parts, and Geraldine gave 4.5 years in the house.
And then you went to the local secondary school. Yeah. And did you go on then to university?
I did, yeah.
In Galway?
Yeah.
To study psychology, I presume.
Yeah, I really, Sean, I never knew what I wanted. You know, coming from a background like that, you're not sure what you want. I think people often see me as ambitious, or my best friend who spent her whole life in England thinks I was very ambitious, but I never looked on myself that way. I knew what I didn't want. I sort of knew that I wanted to go to college at some stage and keep learning in some way, but at the same time, I was a procrastinator. I wasn't a studious person. Mm-hmm. Of course, you didn't want to appear studious in any event. I mean, you were supposed to carry out that trick of getting exams but not studying. You know, the worst thing you could be was a nerd.
A swat.
A swat. That would be the worst insult one could get. So there's such a mixture in my head in relation to it. My sisters and brothers would be the same, and at different, you know, there's such a wide range of experience in our house, just on every level, really.
Despite the awful loss of your mother when you were still only a child, I suppose, was it a secure kind of a happy house that you lived in, that you grew up in?
You know, as I say, 14 people will give what's left now. There are 5 dead, but everybody will give a different story. Of course, I think there were so many joyful moments, so much happiness. Music, you know, I remember records being played when my mother was alive and dancing. And subsequently, my father loved dancing, and down the road, he married again. And they loved, he was a dancer. He didn't drink, he did smoke, chain smoker, but he loved waltzing and dancing, and they lived for that. We were embarrassed because they'd spend the whole night out with a 7-up. Never drinking, and we'd say, well, buy something, you know. Yeah, but
would you like a mineral?
Yeah. But that was yeah, he worked solid. He worked, but he said he never regarded it as work.
What did he do?
He loved it. He started out as a plasterer, and then he became a small builder. He did just about everything. He was always taken with boats, so he built boats as well. He sailed boats, and so did his brothers, you know, so the Condley brothers. But and then eventually he made model boats, and we all have a model boat. I've one in my office, actually. And going back, I gave one to Mayor Daly when I was mayor, and I went over, I gave him one of these small hookers, a gaucho, it's called, a pretty thing.
Yeah. So it was sailing on the sea as opposed to the carib.
Oh, no, the sea. I live with a husband who loves the carib, but I'm afraid it was the sea, the wildness of the sea.
Yeah, and were you sporty yourself?
Was I sporty? Yes, we were all sporty. Did I take part in a club? No. Did I do marathons, triathlons? Absolutely, yes.
But you did?
Yes, but one just did those in our house, you know. My dad started running with us when he was in his 50s. At that stage, he had remarried and my stepmother would have all his gear ready for him for running and playing badminton up in the Chantilly Community Centre, which we all did. And we would embarrass him because we'd run around the pitch and come in muddy instead of being in all our white gear, you know. So we played badminton. But most of it came later. That's not quite true. I mean, we played on the street all the time. We were fit. And
was there politics in the house?
No, never any politics in my house. There was politics in my uncle's house and both uncles. No, not in my father. No.
One of the things I remember growing up, I mean, in my, I think, early teens, Chantilly was in the news for unfortunate reasons. There was a big controversy blew up about the allocation of a house in Chantilly to a Mrs. Fury. She was a traveller woman, or an itinerant was the word used then. Do you remember any of that?
I do. I remember it. It was after my mother had died. I remember it vividly, and it's an absolute vivid picture in my head. I remember the protest at the bottom of our road. My father kept us in. He wouldn't have anything to do with it. However, he didn't do that in a way that was looking down on the protest. I think what my father gave me and my siblings was an ability to see it from both sides. And so while we certainly were not allowed to take part in that protest and we were kept inside in the house, we were aware of the protest at the bottom of the street. We were also aware of the hypocrisy of the institutions that were forcing something without consultation, in a sense, looking down on the area. That has stayed with me all my life, that framing of a narrative, as opposed to looking, how can we house people in Galway in a manner that's fair and just? Because a home is the most essential thing. It's not a product to be bought and sold. So if I go back to the images of them, I think we got the ability there. Maybe it was encapsulated at that point, both inside and outside, to understand it from both sides. But hypocrisy, I would say we're all allergic to hypocrisy. I have no problem disagreeing with somebody if they believe in what they're saying. But spin, I have little tolerance for spin, I have to tell you.
Where do you see spin? Do you see it everywhere?
I certainly see it in increasing measures with each government. I see more and more journalists crossing the line and going in, and there seems to be very little time for reflection. So one minute you're a journalist, supposedly holding the system to account, and the next thing you're advising the system.
That can be done for economic reasons.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm the first. Mm. I see how difficult it is to be a journalist and cameramen, and absolutely. So there's no personal thing here. It's more, and what is happening with our democratic system that we need spin doctors. I mean, I would be perhaps the first to cross and take a job, but I would hope there would be a system that would say, what's happening here? I think that's the role, that's the part that's missing. What's happening to our democratic system? Who's holding who to account?
Well, I mean, opposition holds government
to account. We try our best. We absolutely try our best. You can see there's been a huge attempt to blur the boundaries between opposition and government, which is very serious, leaving out personalities. Blurring the boundary between opposition and government is dangerous. Having spin doctors is very dangerous. And it's something, actually, Sean, that struck with me with all the elections. I've said in the Dáil, I didn't meet anybody at a door that said, I want a reduction in taxes. And probably they'll ring in and tell you after this they did. But I wasn't aware of somebody asking me for a reduction in taxes. They were crying out for services. The ones I've mentioned, public health, housing, public childcare, public transport.
They
were crying
out
for honesty. They didn't have to agree with me. There are issues in Galway where people disagree with me. But I think they respect that I'm consistent. They know where to stand with me. And if I could say that about the system, I would be happy.
But as an independent, have you been able to achieve much or to achieve anything in your years in Dáil Éireann?
Again, you see, that question is framed again. What kind of a democracy would we have without opposition, without a variety of speakers? What have we achieved in opposition? I think we have achieved quite a lot in each Dáil. I remember when Claire Daly was there, Maureen O'Sullivan, Tommy Bruin, Thomas Pringle. And there was a whole range of voices that was speaking, having done their research and in a very pragmatic way and putting forward alternative solutions. Say housing. I spent 17 years of my life on the City Council. I did other things as well. But I watched with disgust and despair as they stopped building housing in 2009. Not a single public house was built on public land from 2009 onwards.
There was a big shift. If you recall where you grew up in Chantilly, they were corporation houses. You paid a weekly rent for them. And then there was the adjusted rent depending on ability to pay. And then there was the tenant purchase scheme. And people then were able to buy those houses. And an awful lot of them went out of the system and became private. And people had their own home. And that was seen as a very good thing. And I suppose it wasn't a huge jump to go from that to the state allowing people to live in houses that were built by the private sector. And they argued that it provided for a better social mix. I mean, would you prefer or would you advocate returning to the point where there was state building of houses on state-owned land that stayed in state ownership and were rented only?
Absolutely. And this word about social mix, you know, there were times where I wouldn't like to have lived next to a bank manager or bank officials, you know. So this word social mix deserves discussion. So if we go back to the fundamental point, if you stop building public housing, and I use the word public housing because it should be extended out, we should change the thresholds, the income thresholds. If you stop building public housing on public land, you're going to create a crisis. And that's what happened from 2009 onwards. Not a single... Parallel with that, we brought in a system called HAP, Housing Assistance Payment, putting the money straight into the landlord's pocket, and we called it social housing. It was a twisting of language. That was a huge turning point where we looked on private housing, like you said, as social housing, paying HAP. The rent is extraordinary high, 2,000, 2,500, 3,000 in Galway to rent a three-bedroom house. And the HAP limits don't even meet it. And we have homelessness at crisis point.
Fundamentally, though, I suppose a lot of people want the opportunity to own their home. So realistically, is it a long-term option for people to be renting for as long as they live?
We've corporatised the whole area of housing. We've made it into a product to be bought and sold. And then we copper-fastened that with legislation. And then we insulted people by saying that's social housing. So we've twisted language on its head. So a republic has to provide homes and housing for its people. And you do that through a mixture. You do it through public housing on public land, and you do it through cost rental houses and through home ownership.
So one of the elements, would it be, in your view, go back to the idea of building estates that were corporation or city council owned and rented to people based on ability to pay?
You see, all of those words really, you know, corporation, council houses, they're all bringing in a cause for reflection on our prejudice. Really?
Forgive me if I sound like I'm prejudiced, but you have to use some words if you're trying to communicate.
I think you're absolutely right, but they're all the words that have been used for years. A house is a home, and the council built very good houses. And so if we look at Chantilly, and I think before this we discussed the prices of houses in Chantilly, and to all intents and purposes, the appearances of the houses haven't changed, but what has changed is the perception. So that will tell you how flimsical or how ephemeral the market is in terms of now we suddenly perceive Chantilly as an excellent place to live, right beside the university, right beside the hospital. But it had always that location. But we just didn't use those words, did we? But now we can use it because the market is saying, oh, good Lord, that house is worth 500,000 or
so. I saw one in the Business Post, I think it was saying to you earlier, in Chantilly for over 800,000. Now it had been well extended and well done up and all the rest of it.
But similarly in the Claddagh where I live, similarly in Bohermore, when I'm not personalising it to you. But maybe we should reflect on our use of language when we talk about that. And maybe we should, how did a home become a product? How did that happen?
The city of Galway, as is well known, is almost incessantly congested for many hours of the day. Now, you talk about having a green transport system, and I think you've spoken before about having a light rail system. Where are you on the proposed bridge, which has been proposed and passed and then stymied and looks like it's going to come back on the agenda? That ring road around the city with a new bridge across the Corrib north of the city centre.
Am I allowed by parochial? Am I allowed go local? OK. I was elected in 1999. I thought the proposed outer bypass was madness then. I'm in a minority, let me say. I have consistently put forward different solutions. And all I've seen happen in Galway is the traffic congestion worsen. And from 1999 onwards, the title of the project has changed. So we went from the outer bypass to a ring road to an N6 project or vice versa. And all during that time, no other solutions were put forward. So when I was, I hate when, saying when I was mayor, but lots of people have been mayor of Galway. During my term, I had the privilege, or maybe the opposite privilege, of putting through the city development plan, which became law on the 1st of February 2005. And in that city development plan were two objectives, Sean, to roll out park and ride on the east and west side of the city. That was 2005. That has never happened. All along that time, I collected 24,000 signatures many years ago for a feasibility study for light rail. I stood with a small team in March and February on the streets of Galway. We took nothing online and we took 24,000 signatures asking for a feasibility study for light rail. It took until last year to publish that. We need fundamental change, and Galway should be taken as a pilot city for a green, lean city. Roll it out. Now we need it.
And no need, you say, for the ring road and all the, that goes with it.
The ring road, the actual ring road, and when you look at what's been said, and I attended the consultation meeting, most people want to go into Galway. I'd be careful with figures. Over 90% want to go into Galway. So we're not looking at solutions of where the people want to go to. Of course, we need to improve the road in Connemara. Absolutely need to improve it.
Let's go back a little bit to your time on the council. You were a member of the Labour Party. You were a councillor for the Labour Party.
I was, yeah.
Not for all of your years on the council. You left the party, was it in 2000?
I never quite left the party, but the party left me. I have no memory of leaving the Labour Party, but certainly it left me. But I joined them in 1999. I became a councillor, I became an alderman in the West Ward. I actually didn't know what the word meant, and it meant you were first elected. So that was 99. In 2004, when I stood, I was already living in the Cladda in 99, but I stood in the west side where I was from. And I actually say it was my father and his honesty and his hard work that really led to a lot of my success. He was known as an honest, hardworking man. And I was able to go to the doors and say, I'm not promising you anything. I remember whoever was with me from the Labour Party was saying, you can't do that. And I said, I'm not. I'm as angry as people are at the door. We should have facilities. We should have planes on. So fast forward 2004, I became mayor of Galway. Somewhere between that and seven, I was gone from the Labour Party.
You probably don't like to use the word row, but was there a row?
No, there wasn't. You see, actually, there wasn't a row.
Well, there must have been a difference of opinion because
absolutely.
Of opinion.
Well, absolutely, there was a difference.
You wanted to stand for the Dáil?
By seven. By 2007, 6-7, I said I was going to stand, and therein was a problem. But the problem
was that Michael D didn't want another. He didn't want a running mate.
You're asking me, was the row? There was no row. I simply said I'm standing, you know, because I had seen that people in Galway were crying out for change. For example, recycling. You know, I feel it's deja vu when I heard them talking about bring the cans back and recycling. We had that going theoretically back in 21, 22, because they planned to put in an incinerator. And there was an outrage from the ground up. It wasn't an NIMBYism. It was, we want zero waste. There were monster meetings up in the Car of Great Southern. 1,000 people. But there were speakers from Oregon and from New Zealand and from Australia telling us the way forward. I saw that, and they were leading us by the nose. Please recycle. This is 20 odd years ago. I felt the Labour should be leading with that and sustainable development well before we declared a climate emergency. But they didn't embrace that. To me, they were always a little bit too worried to lead. So they left the middle ground open, the Green Party and Sinn Féin, and they left a gap. So at some stage, we parted ways.
Did come down to the fact that you wanted to stand, but Labour wouldn't have you as a second candidate for Dáil Éireann.
Well, you can put it any way you like.
Is that factually the position?
What is factual is that I said, I'm standing. The actual point of departure, I think, was funny because I was at a council meet with Tom Costello, and I greatly respected Tom. He was in the Labour Party for years and is still there. And some topic came up and I said, I didn't agree with that. And they said, but your whip did. And I said, I never had a whip. And that seemed to, they started laughing. And that seemed to have been the moment.
So are you essentially an independent spirit and party systems don't really suit you?
No, I work very well with people. You know, I got elected as Les Kancorla. I work with people, and I think we should work together more often on the topics that are important.
I know we're jumping a little back and forth, and there's no harm to do that between local and national politics. Yeah. But it was something of a surprise when you became Les Kancorla in the previous stall. How did that come about?
It's funny in one sense, but not really. It came about by accident, one would say, but not really accident. I discussed it with Thomas Pringle and a few others that there was nobody standing, there was no competition. So if anybody stood besides myself, I would have supported them, because I really believe it's important to give competition, and we can't give out as an opposition and then not provide a candidate. So we felt we hadn't a hope, but we thought, and this conversation actually took place, you know, you haven't a hope. Yeah, I know that. But do you want to go? No, no. So I said, well, it's important, and if we galvanise the opposition, then we'll have a credible turnout, and we can show that the opposition want somebody else. And that's what happened. Actually, that's exactly what happened.
You got it, and Fergus O'Dowd, the government's candidate, was defeated. But it didn't turn out to be possible to repeat that more recently when it came to the election of Ciarán Cóirle. I mean, what was supposed to be done by the members of the House was overridden by the two parties, effectively the two main parties, Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil, imposing a whip, even though it was a secret vote.
Yeah, it's something that I'm uncomfortable with, because we took apparently politics out of it in 2016 by bringing in the secret ballot, and we've really undone that, really. We've gone back on it, even though there's still a secret ballot. But I hadn't made the jump to getting the position, I have to tell you. I'm sure Fergus is not too happy listening if he hears this, but the important thing was to give competition. I didn't foresee getting the job, actually. I really didn't, and neither did my colleagues. So in a sense, that took a little...
Did you enjoy doing it?
I didn't enjoy it first, I have to say, but I realised what a privilege it was. And I think it was just showing the... I didn't anticipate the win. I anticipated the fight and the competition genuinely, and to have a credible performance and galvanise the opposition and make our words mean something. So it was... When I got it, it was a surprise to me, but I tried to rise to the occasion.
That, of course, was an election confined to the members of Dáil Éireann. And there's another election coming up this year, and your name has been mentioned as a possible candidate. That's for the position of Uachtaráin na hÉireann. You featured strongly enough in a recent poll where people were asked to identify a left-wing candidate, and you were right up there. Is that something you would give consideration to?
It's a very difficult question for me, because that was brought to my attention. I actually didn't see it. I bought the paper but didn't see it. It was brought to my attention, and it has been brought to my attention on social media. It was certainly never something I considered. And it's a privilege to actually even have people highlighting that perhaps I might do it. I don't know how to answer this question, Sean, other than I'm in a space where this, if there was a chance to unite the opposition, certainly in that situation, I would keep my mind open.
Because there is, informally, I think at this stage, the beginnings of a search and a conversation among the opposition parties to see, is there somebody that could all unite behind to stand for the presidency?
Yeah, I've seen that, yeah.
Have you been part of any of those conversations?
No, I have not. I have not. But if the opportunity arose to galvanise the opposition...
You might be available. You would be available.
Well, I'd certainly look at that, but only on those terms.
Okay. Yeah. So, look, interesting times ahead, perhaps. Would you intend to stand for the Dáil again?
I say every day I'm getting out of politics, but I haven't done that. And I think, you know, politics is a public service, really. And I've said it's a privilege and we're paid, and it's a public service. And I have always adopted, again, going back to my own family, you do it to the best of your ability, whatever job you do. It doesn't matter what job, it's to the best of your ability. And that would be instinctual in me.
You're in opposition now with several other independents. There are other groupings. There's the Labour Party, there's the Sock Dems, there's Sinn Féin, and a strong left presence. And the objective of some of those groups is to have a left-led government after the next election, 2027 or wherever, whenever that may be. Could you see yourself, and would you want to be part of that, up and including maybe a ministry of some sort, and taking what goes with it, accepting a government whip.
I have no difficulty. The word whip doesn't do anything for me as a woman. You know, I just don't like the word and it's never appealed to me. But I have no difficulty agreeing on topics that are important. And I've always felt that the left should have come together on basic principles. And you might have disagreement on other issues, but there should be no disagreement on the left on fundamentals like public housing and public land, and stop treating a house as an asset. Public health. I can't believe that I'm in a city where on any given day there are 50 to 70 people on trolleys, and I'm throwing these words out, but this could be your father, your sister, your wife, and it's just appalling and unacceptable, and it should not be taking place. And so we need voices to say that, and the opposition should be united on that. We need an integrated public transport system. Galway City is crying out for it.
Yeah, but
so just on those issues, so you don't want to be parochial, and I appreciate that, but the issues, that's what we should unite on the left.
But could you see yourself being part of a programme for government and saying, OK, I'm into this now, I'm in for the 5 years, in good days and bad, to borrow Lowry's phrase?
It's a bad example to give me in terms, you know, but absolutely, so that's what we stand in politics for. But you can't join a government that's going ahead with the same approach or policies that have caused the problems in the first place.
The push towards Ireland becoming militarily involved. Micheál Martin said the Taoiseach in the last few days, look, the idea of a European army is simply not on the agenda at the moment, despite the crisis in Ukraine and despite what President Zelensky wants to see happen.
I find this topic very, very serious, and I'm extremely concerned that we're now heading to ongoing wars permanently. I'm currently reading a book on Churchill, which I bought when I went up to Kenny's bookshop for something else and came away with it. And I'm reading Churchill. And that followed on from a book on Asquith, I think, Precipice, writing letters.
Well, Robert Harris's book, writing
letters to his lover in her 20s while he was at war cabinet meetings. And that comes up again in Churchill's book. And so I'm reading Churchill's book, and complex man, but loved war, loved playing with soldiers. And at these cabinet meetings where the Prime Minister is sending love letters to his 20-something-year-old and whatever is on Churchill's mind, they're making decisions to send thousands and thousands to their death in the Dardanelles and so on. And I'm reading that. And then there's another book that I keep going back to called The Dark Valley from the 30s. And it's Pierce Brendan. And I take it down from my shelf, Sean, regularly, and I look at the 30s, and it's a panoramic view of the countries in Europe leading into the war. What's astonishing, really, is the amount of time that the Germans, the government people, voted against Hitler, but nevertheless in the end. So why am I mentioning those books? Because they're really striking a chord with me in terms of what's happening today and the warmongering and the language that's going on and the arguments in Ireland being reduced to your furrows are against us, or we're the soft belly, the underbelly of Europe, or freeloading.
I
find, just on this, I'm absolutely, as a mother, as a woman, I'm absolutely passionate that this is unacceptable. We cannot have warmongering like this and stand idly by. We need, as a country that's a republic in theory, as an independent sovereign state, to use our voice for peace. More than ever, that's what we need to do.
Yes, but going back to Churchill, I don't know how far into the book you're
200 pages.
Well, it's probably runs for about 700 or 800 if it's going to be a book about Churchill, yeah, to cover everything. But in the Second World War, you could say he was the one who was first and foremost in the breach against fascism, against Hitler. And it was an awful war, as all wars are. And he did what had to be done to preserve freedom and democracy. That would be the way his supporters and admirers would see it.
We're in a world today where we're now, it's the war of the empires, really, isn't it? It's the war of the empires. To me, that's what's happening. And so we have a particular language, and rightly so, of what Russia did when they invaded Ukraine. But the same approach is not taken at all with America or with Israel. So that in itself, we need to use our voices in relation to that, to highlight what's happening. How can our country have credibility if we join in on this side with America and with Europe, and then on the other side ignore what's happened?
But just on one particular thing, I mean, it was reported that you were criticised, I think, for a less than enthusiastic clapping reaction when the Ukrainian president, Vladimir Zelensky, addressed the houses of the Oireachtas. I mean, were you half-hearted about that?
Can you imagine? Can you imagine that's what journalism in this country? It's an analysis of the duration and intensity of my clapping. That's what the analysis of that was about, as opposed to what were your feelings? What did you think? I actually felt nauseated, actually, at the war in the Ukraine, at what was happening, and also at the analysis around that. And could it have been avoided, the invasion of the Ukraine? Could it have been avoided? Were there previous agreements that weren't upheld? I'm going to repeat it again, nauseated.
Zelensky's speech or by the reaction to it?
It was almost like a celebration of war, which I know it wasn't. It wasn't. But that's what it felt like to me as a woman. I wanted to show respect to the man, absolutely. But to judge the duration and intensity of my clapping is just fills me with despair, really. As opposed to what can this country do with our history, which is a very specific history. We've lived through hundreds of years of colonization, many failed attempts to get our freedom. We finally get it. And so we've a unique perspective from that historical perspective, and our role in the UN.
Whatever about a European army, there's no doubt about it that there's serious pressure all over Europe and within the European Union to increase spending on defence. That's partly prompted by Donald Trump suggesting that the Americans are not going to continue to support NATO if the NATO other NATO members aren't paying their share, as he would see it. But we see in recent times, we see the Danes, the British, the French, pretty much all the countries in Europe. And we saw some of the Nordic countries, Finland and Sweden, joining NATO. And that's not done out of warmongering, one surmises, but out of a sense of fear as to what Vladimir Putin may do.
There's certainly fear in the neighbouring countries. However, I canvassed in the Lisbon Treaty. I read the Lisbon Treaty and I was appalled at what was in the Lisbon Treaty. And similarly with Nice, they ran them twice because the people of Ireland saw what was in those. And it was an absolute militarisation. The path was set out completely for the militarisation of Europe. And so concerned were the people that they rejected Nice and Lisbon twice. And so they had to vote again, but protections were put in that we were not going to lose our neutrality, our words to that effect, or the triple lock. Now we have a constant choreographed campaign to get rid of our triple lock.
The triple lock there, it requires cabinet approval, Oireachtas approval, and then Security Council approval if any a group of Irish military over 12 members, I think, is to be deployed outside the state. But if you leave it to the UN Security Council, you have members there who can use a veto, and it may not be in our best interests, or it may be something that holds us back from doing something very worthwhile. Isn't that the argument?
It's a tiresome argument, actually, because in the Dáil repeatedly they told us the veto was being misused by Russia, because that suited the narrative. And of course it was being misused by Russia, but they failed to tell us that America was also misusing the veto, as were the other three permanent members misusing it. So at the very least, if you're going to tell us one country is misusing it, tell us how the others did as well. If you want to be credible and if you want us to see the importance of changing it, that has never been done, Sean. I only can look, read and analyse. And to me, we need to back the UN now more than ever. This word, rules-based order, frightens me. Okay, I don't know what a rules-based order means. We have international law and we have obligations under international law.
But it's ignored wholesale by...
It's been diminished with the words rule-based order. That's number one. Number two, then, as a country, we need to value international law. Of course, what did you say? It's been ignored. Absolutely. But it's been ignored by America.
Absolutely.
It's been ignored by Israel.
And by Russia. And by China when it suits them as well.
Absolutely. So now we're in the world of politics. So if we're going to pick one empire. Let's be honest about that. Let's say that's what we're doing, as opposed to another empire in the War of the Empires. Or do we come back as a republic and say, what is our role here?
But we weren't really, we were militarily neutral, I suppose, in the Second World War, but we weren't actually neutral in the sense that, you know, we provided all sorts of surreptitious assistance to the Allies in terms of information about ports, information about weather, that kind of thing. I mean, Ronan Fanning, the late Ronan Fanning, has illustrated that fairly comprehensively in his work. So, I mean, we mightn't have people firing guns in war situations, but we have taken sides.
We're talking here about a military industrial complex and spending vast amount of money on bombs and war. Look at the state of Palestine. Yeah. Just look at the state of Palestine. There's no Palestine left. And we're taking credit for recognising Palestine. And on that level, Ireland has done well. 2,000-pound bombs. As a human being, as a woman, how can I not say this is totally wrong? Did I raise two boys for this, for war? Or did I raise them to say, there is a better way? We have intelligence. We can use that to find a different way. We can't house our people. We have people on trolleys and we want to keep raising our defence budget. I've no problem raising our budget for better conditions for the army and so on. I've no problem with any of that. But as a peacekeeping force, we need to go back to basics, and our army should be used as a peacekeeping force.
You were one of a number of TDs who visited Syria. I'm not quite sure what the year was, but you were criticised, among others, by, for instance, people like Professor Bridget Laffan, who said fairly recently, and this is the context of Syria and what emerged in terms of the Assad regime and its atrocities and the horrific prisons and that kind of thing, and torture chambers that they had. She made the point that Irish TDs visited Syria under Assad, and one of them remains in the Dáil. That's you. Catherine Connolly, she said, should apologise to the Syrian people for her support of the regime.
I went to Syria. I was appalled at the destruction. It was a unique experience to go from Damascus to Aleppo and see the appalling destruction of war and the destruction of the Palestinian refugee camp. If it did anything for me, it helped me to realise that war is absolutely should be avoided at all costs. And we have to use our intelligence to find a way.
Was it a visit that could be interpreted as giving some sort of comfort to the regime? Not that they would probably notice too much comfort at the top of the regime.
Certainly not from my point of view, or the people that were with me. Nobody's in any doubt what I thought of Assad.
But signals do count for something. I mean, you frequently wear the kefaya, is that the correct word for it? The scarf, which indicates support for the Palestinian cause, and for very good reasons. I mean, it can be argued. So, I mean, body language is interpreted whether we like it or not, and statements and where we appear and what we do.
I didn't make statements except my horror of war and the destruction in Syria.
And Do you have any regrets about going?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. And I listened carefully to a wide variety of people.
Mm. Would you consider, for instance, visiting Israel and meeting some of those families who were bereaved by the attack on the 7th of October?
I'd be open to any. In fact, we were reared on Leon Uris. Do you remember Leon Uris? Mm. And we all wanted Trinity. To go to Trinity and all that series of books. Mm. And I've just read everything I possibly can on the Second World War and the Holocaust. Mm. It's absolutely, I mean, words like appalling don't capture.
Mm. Wasn't there something inevitable, though, when you had that attack, the massacre of 1,200 people and the taking of the hostages by Hamas, you didn't need to be a Middle Eastern specialist to know that Israel would respond in an extremely vigorous way, arguably, and it was predictable, out of all proportion.
Israel hasn't responded in a vigorous way. Israel has responded in a genocidal way and is committing genocide on the ground. One of the books that I keep going back to, and I feel I'm going back to a lot of books, is The 100 Years War on Palestine. And a more recent one, The A to Z of Palestine by Kate Thompson. But The 100 Years War on Palestine by Khalidi, I keep going back to it. It's a very fair book. And Palestine never had a chance amongst the big powers from day one. The Balfour Declaration in 1917 only copperfastened what had been going on from the 1880s by the Zionists. Anti-Semitic speaking out on Palestine is not anywhere remotely connected with being anti-Semitic.
Why might you visit Israel?
I would visit Palestine in the morning. I would visit Israel. I'd visit any country that allowed me to listen. My mind is not closed, but I can tell you the horror of what Israel has done. I doubt if they'll be giving me an invitation any day because of what I've said and other people in the Dáil. You brought up when they went over and killed 1,200 people and took hostages. On the Dáil, I'm on the record for saying that was wrong. But it did not start on that day. The history of Palestine and Israel did not start on that day.
That's absolutely the point. But you'd have to wonder why would a group like Hamas bring upon their own people the kind of terror? You use the word genocide. Some people wouldn't go that far. But in any event, it has been
before the International Criminal Court.
Absolute destruction. And it's not that the thing began on that date, but the consequences were entirely predictable.
One would have to ask the question why Netanyahu funded Hamas. Remember that?
It was, I suppose, his way. He foolishly, I suppose he would say in hindsight, thought he could keep them under control.
No, he didn't.
And by giving them a certain amount of latitude.
Certainly. He wanted to divide and conquer. So let's look at what's happened here. We have Palestine struggling to be a nation, to be a country, and we have Israel preventing that at every... Now, I can see they're worried about safety, but it was worked out from day one that that was going to be their area regardless. The Balfour Declaration doesn't even mention the Palestinians. It talks about the non-Jewish people.
When you spoke recently about the new programme for government, you were quite critical of the language in that programme where it talked about progressing the Occupied Territories Bill, not enacting the Occupied Territories Bill. The point has been made that there's a perception out there that Ireland is anti-Israel and passing that bill won't achieve a whole lot. It won't actually improve the lives of the Palestinian people, but it could seriously damage the Irish economy.
See, these arguments have been used all the time. They've been used in relation to apartheid in South Africa as well, over and over. It's the least thing we could do is to pass the Occupied Territories Bill. The court has given a judgment on that, an interim judgment on that, told us we have an obligation to act. Are we going to take the rules order seriously or the international law? Are we just going to pick and choose? Is that what we do as a republic? Or do we build up credibility and consistency? I have no problem. My difficulty is with the Israeli government and the army. And any sane person has to be worried about what they've done and what they've said for democracy in the world.
And but their enemy is a group of people who vow that they want to end the state of Israel, that Israel has no right to exist. That's the Hezbollah, that's the Hamas line.
I understand that that's been changed, but I'd have huge difficulty with that. I have no problem saying that, but I understand they've changed that. But one has to look at where has Hamas come from. What has happened here? It's worthy of discussion, the history of Palestine and what has happened. And what happened leading up to that? I make no excuses for what happened. I've condemned it out of hand. However, we have the privilege of being outside that. And we can look at that and analyse and say, what has gone on here? So we've had a country under siege. We've had something like, is it 600 to 800 trucks going in daily to keep the population alive? And we've had destruction out of all proportion.
As we speak, it's still not clear whether the White House will extend the usual invitation to the Taoiseach to go there on St. Patrick's Day. Your view on that?
My view on that, it was actually, I'm slightly different in the sense that I didn't call for the ambassador of Israel to be thrown out. I felt she should have been brought in repeatedly and our views made clear to her as to what we thought. And similarly with the invitation to the White House, it's something we've done repeatedly every year. If I was Taoiseach, there would be no doubt as to where I stand when I'm talking to the President of America.
You'd go and let him have it.
Well, I wouldn't quite put it like that, but I think there's an onus on us to be who we are and where we stand in the world.
I would surmise that you might be a bit like that preacher at the religious ceremony in Washington Cathedral the day after the inauguration.
Yeah, well, my father in heaven would get a nice laugh at the idea that I might be a preacher and the hard time I give him, but there you are. But I'm the preacher, yes, the preacher did well.
When you talk to your mother and your siblings who've passed from this life, is that a kind of a prayer or what is it?
It's funny. You can't get away from prayer in that sense. I mean, I've left the Catholic religion, but you can't get away from the ritual and the communication. And it's more, my eldest sister died on her birthday in 2013. I talk to her every day. She's part of what I am. She's with me. So
do you sense that she prompts you back, maybe with planting thoughts or something like that?
She was an unusual woman in the sense in that she was very, she took time to reflect. And in fact, actually, when she was dying in the hospital, I asked her what it was like. And she said, I don't know, I've never been here before, but I come back to you. And she actually came back. Maybe a day or two later, and she said, you know, I think it's going to be okay, Kathleen, because that's what I'm known as. She said, I'm swimming and my family are swimming with me. And she had that ability, even on her deathbed, even though she didn't want to die, but she accepted she was dying. She had six children. She always adopted that push. I'm not really sure, but I'll reflect on it and I'll come back to you. And she did. She did.
So you talked to your mother, you talked to your sister and your other siblings who are no longer with you. Do you think you'll meet them when you die yourself?
No, I don't. But I think they're with me. I think they're with me.
Catherine Connolly, it's been absolutely fascinating listening to you and hearing your insights. Thank you so much.
Fáilte.
To hear more in this series, go to rte.ie/podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.